But I think this is a kind of a beginning in the direction. In specific, I will present you a model of a generic model of evolution of migration. When we started begin working on collective movement, we thought that migration is one fascinating phenomenon that occurs across a wide range of organisms, and it occurs in a range of ways, from solitary migrations to collective migrations, and where migratory individuals and non-migratory individuals can also coexist. So we want to build a general framework to study this. I will present that, and followed by, I really wanted to present the second one, which is cannibalism, how cannibalism can also drive collective migration, but unfortunately I don't think I'll be able to do that today. And then I'll go on to the third topic, which is we did an experiment, some kind of a fusion of experiments and simulations. So I'm going to present those two, the second one and the fourth one today. So I would like to begin with this extremely fascinating video of collectively moving organisms being attacked by predators. And it's fascinating from many, many perspectives. It's fascinating as a naive observer, you know, how do these organisms do these kind of, you know, just visually appealing. And scientifically, of course, they're fascinating. You know, how can these individuals who form groups of hundreds of thousands of individuals can coordinate their motion in such spectacular ways? And how can we understand it? Because obviously a fish at one corner of a group cannot talk to or interact to in any ways to another fish in another corner of the group. But how can we explain them using very simple rules that individuals can follow? And in the direction, mathematical models, as this video shows, this is a result of mathematical model simulation. As this shows, some mathematical models developed by physicists have been extremely successful in explaining some of the realistic looking features. And another fascinating aspect of these systems is these are groups of unrelated individuals. They are not like honeybee colonies or ant colonies where you have highly related individuals, you know, having a common purpose of, you know, roughly it's there the group selection arguments can be easily applied. Whereas here, the selection probably most strongly applies at the level of individuals. Given that, how can you explain this behavior? That's one of the questions that I'm extremely fascinated with. And I don't think we have all the answers, but we are getting somewhere. So let me begin with a broad relevance of collective behavior. It's a ubiquitous stuff. It's found across a range of organisms, from bacterial systems to swarms of locusts and other insects to wildebeests, and also in humans. And from a physics point of view, people have been thinking of these as non-equilibrium systems because they drive energy from the external world and they dissipate energy. As a process, they move. And when they move, they interact with one another just like gaseous molecules. And so what kind of new physics can we learn from these biological systems? That has been one major, in fact, surprisingly so, much of the early work in the 90s happened in the physics community. And there has also been a lot of interest in robotics community because engineers want to send these autonomous robots who can survey the environment. Now, what kind of rules should you assign to these robots that can map the environment in an efficient way? How should they communicate to one another? Should it be a distributed control? Should it be a centralized control? And people have been again fascinated by these swarming systems where there is no centralized designer or a control, but nevertheless, as a group, these groups really function very, very well efficiently under many circumstances. And computer scientists are interested in devising algorithms that can solve complex problems. And they call them natural algorithms, which are biologically inspired algorithms to solve complex problems. And it has implications in traffic organizations as well as managed human crowds. This is just to give you a broad relevance of collective behavior, why people are interested in these systems. And one central question, as I kind of already indicated to you all, is how local interaction is. How local interactions among individuals, for example, these are golden shiners that are found in North Indian freshwater lakes. How interaction at the level of individuals scale to give rise to collective self-organized motion. And people have studied this using a number of perspectives. As I already mentioned, there have been studied as self-driven interacting particles. People have devised agent-based models where each individual fish can be thought of an agent which is moving in space, and as it moves, it interacts with their neighbors. Just using very simple rules. For example, I would like to align with the direction of my near neighbors. Not really far off neighbors, but just the near neighbors. With a very simple rule, can we understand some of these patterns. and they have been very successful in doing so. And physicists obviously have a tendency to simplify, rather oversimplify, many biological features. And biologists have extended on them and have introduced many realistic features, because, for example, when two individuals come close to each other, they don't really go over them, they actually repel from one another. These kind of realistic rules they have implemented, and in fact you do find some more realistic patterns by implementing these kind of additional rules. And the third approach is active matter approach, where you write down certain partial differential equations to understand these systems. Okay. Now, as I said, the local interactions drive this collective motion, and we know from our understanding of evolution that these local interactions are not fixed over time. They can be under selection for a number of reasons. So in principle, these interactions can change over evolutionary timescales. So given that, okay, we have set up rules that produces these kind of patterns. Now the question is, why do organisms have these kind of local interactions at all? Of course, we know that not every species that we know of produces these kind of fascinating patterns. Some of them are just happy being solitary. Some of them are, you know, even though they group, but they don't necessarily show very spectacular patterns. So how do different organisms have, what kind of selection pressures from the ecology has led to these kind of different interactions that in turn generate the macroscopic patterns? So that has been my interest. Why do such interactions occur? Of course, one might argue at a very basic level that, you know, these local interactions lead to some emergent properties that are beneficial to the entire group. And we have been kind of hearing, you know, we do keep hearing such arguments all the time. And for example, such one of the emergent properties, for example, could be that an entire group might navigate more efficiently than an individual alone could by socially interacting with one another. So that could be one instance where one can argue that, you know, yeah, there is an emergent benefit to the entire group, so every individual gains the benefit. However, we have to think carefully, because such navigation ability could come at a cost to certain individuals. So, but not, cost is not always necessarily equally shared among all the individuals. So it's much more apt to study from an individual level how every individual who is trying to maximize relative fitness will eventually lead to this kind of collective motion patterns. So this is the basic question I'm going to address. I'm going to present two recent work that I have done with Ian Cousin and many other fantastic collaborators. Okay. So I will introduce a very simple model of collective motion and migration. So feel free to stop me, because I'm going to keep it more like a tutorial kind of a setup rather than, you know, going through, just breezing through the results. So feel free to interrupt me at any point of time. Okay, so why collective migration? I have already told you that collective migration itself occurs from a range of organisms. These are bacteria. These are locusts that actually can form swarms of roughly a billion individuals, and they can travel thousands of kilometers across continents. And these are wildebeests that are there. One of the only species that I know, a large mammal, which still has a long migration pattern, which is still preserved. And most of us have gone away because of human disturbances. So how do we begin to model such a complex system? So for that, I would like to take a closer look at this picture. So you can observe that these sheep, as a migratory sheep, they seem to be following a global direction of motion. Nevertheless, if you look at details of groups, details of motion within the groups, for example, in that corner, there are massive local fluctuations. In fact, that part of the group where I have highlighted, they almost seem to be going in a vortex. Whereas the entire group as a whole still has a directed motion. And when they pass through this geographical constriction, they will eventually align together and go away. So no, this is a natural. This is a natural environment.
They're not influenced by
anything. No, this is in white. This is in white. These are not shepherd. Taking the sheep. Yes, that's correct.
It's like
a hydrodynamic flow. It does indeed. That's why I said, you know, there are lots of models of hydrodynamics of walking systems, and they have made some very fantastic predictions, and they have even been tested in real world. For example, they exhibit something called chain number fluctuations, and they have been measured and found in systems from bacteria to, you know, even in physical systems. Yeah. Okay. So there is a global direction. There's a tendency to probably go in a global. I'm just motivating. How do we model the migration? So I'm going to introduce the model now. So I want to begin with this picture. You know, how do we begin even modeling such a complex phenomenon? Okay? So the idea, so as we could clearly see, there is a the fact that there are local fluctuations, and the fact that the local individuals are oriented with their neighbors indicate that the range of interactions is rather local. But nevertheless, they do have a global directional pattern, and that could potentially come because some individual might know where to go. Or some they may all have a tendency to go in certain direction, because we do now know that many bird species have ability to detect the magnetic field lines through which they navigate very long distance migration. So there are many mechanisms. I am not going into the details of what mechanisms individuals might use. That could be species specific. So the idea is, but in principle there is a... No, those are indicative really to motivate the rules for the model of migration. Okay. So I'm going to assume that individuals can have two abilities, and I will translate them into mathematical equations. There are not going to be too many equations, it's going to be fairly descriptive. I'll keep it at a descriptive level. So first is an ability to sense environments, and these abilities could come, you know, depending on the species, depending on the environment, these could range from being able to detect geomagnetic field or thermal cues, chemical cues and so on. This could even be just visual cues if you are a large mammal, you know where the resources are increasing with distance. And in addition, individuals have an ability, could have an ability to interact with their neighbors. When I say interact with their neighbors, it could be that I would like to stay close to my neighbors, and I would like to travel in the direction of my neighbors. The average direction of my neighbors, only these two rules. I will describe them more precisely as I go along. So, and I also assume that there is a need to migrate, because if I want to do a model of migration, I have to assume that there is a need to migrate. The question is, if there is a need to migrate, I'm going to define all these, you know, mathematically precisely in the later slides. If there is a need to migrate, and these two are possible traits that individuals can tune over evolutionary time scales. When I say individuals can tune, I don't mean that I'm going to change every other day or something like that. It could be a genetically inheritable trait. How do individuals optimize the balance between these two traits? And when I say individuals, these are the individuals who move in two-dimensional continuous space, and they move with constant speed, and they keep updating the direction of motion. So the rules are going to be, how do you update your direction of motion depending on your ability to sense the environment and your ability to interact with their neighbors. Okay, so let me, before we do a model of collective migration, I want to first introduce how an individual can actually migrate. So I assume that without loss of any generality, that the migratory gradients, as I said, these could be occur from different sources, is in the, along the x direction in my model. So, you know, I could always rotate it to, you know, whatever angle I want, but then I can always say that the direction of motion, the direction of migration, migratory cues along the x-axis. So to be able to detect these gradients, individuals have an ability called omega gi. Omega gi represents ability to detect the gradients. We call that gradient detection trait or gradient detection ability. Okay, so what does this trait really do when we model this trait? And it follows a very simple equation. All that this means is that if your trait is very low, you make large errors from the migratory direction. I already mentioned that the x-axis is where the cues lie. If we have low omega g, we will make errors at every time step in finding out how the cues are. Whereas if we have a strong trait, strong ability to detect gradients, we will make accurate assessment at every time step. Okay? And once you make an assessment of where the cues are, you move in the direction. And as those who are familiar with these kind of equations, there is an element of noise in them. So it is not that at every time step they will find the same direction to go. And it will, so the even though the accuracy is going to be same across time steps, there is going to be some errors in the exact measurement that they do. Okay, this is stochastic migratory model. Okay, so this is how individuals can migrate, and that depends on omega g. Now, what I'm going to do now is, you know, if you want to do an evolutionary model, you have to define some way of fitness. And here, fitness is going to come from two elements. One of them is benefits. So as you migrate, we assume that you accumulate certain benefits. These benefits could be the resources you consume as you go, for example. So we make a very simple assumption here, which is that the benefits are proportional to the distance you move in the direction of the gradient. So the more you move along the x-axis, the more benefits you get. Okay? And so in the plot that I show on the right hand side, what that shows is, as your ability increases, for small values your benefits increase, and eventually it saturates, because obviously you can only get a maximum benefit. Your benefits just cannot keep on increasing. It can only reproduce up to a physical limitation that you have. So just to make it clear, as the omega G state increases, the benefits accumulated increases initially, but eventually saturates to a maximum value. We devise the model parameter such that the maximum value is equal to 1. Okay. So that's the benefit part. And we also assume that the ability to detect these gradients can come with a cost. For example, when you are detecting the gradients, you are probably less vigilant about the predators that might attack you, or there could be energetic expenditure. If you are a bacteria sensing some chemicals, potentially there could be chemical costs. So as I said, this is at an abstract level. We are not modeling a specific system. And of course, if you have ideas about that, I would be delighted to hear more about how we can test some of these predictions. So we assume that the costs grow monotonically with the ability to variabilities. Okay. So you have benefits which increase and then saturate, and you have costs that keep growing. So you put them together, what do you get? We define benefit to be, my fitness of an individual is equal to benefits minus the costs. So clearly, the green line represents the fitness, which is benefits minus the cost. Initially, the benefits increase because it overrides the cost, but eventually the costs keep increasing, right? So the curve turns back. So if you are a solitary individual, it's very clear what you need to do. You have an optimum investment that you have to do in your abilities, which is the peak of the curve. That's the optimum for a solitary individual. This is fairly straightforward. The question arises, what if you allow other individuals to interact with you, and what if you allow yourself to interact with other individuals? So what if you are social? No, why is that interesting? Imagine that I am the guy who is migrating, and I am trying to, and I have invested in finding the direction to migrate, and you accidentally happen to find me, and you just follow me without investing anything in the migration. You will eventually get pretty much all the benefits, but you are not paying any costs. So the optimum that I am showing here may not remain optimum anymore. So what happens under those circumstances? What happens if we introduce social interactions defined specifically by talking interactions? So yeah, question.
So this is assuming that the cost of social interactions is different from the cost of...
Very good point. Yes. Yeah, we have included the possibility of cost of social interactions. That doesn't terribly change results. It does change. If the cost of sociality is extremely high, then probably you don't want to do it anyway. So you can think of what are the ways in which sociality could lead to cost. It could be that if you are in a group, there is more competition for resources, right? That's one way of accruing costs, having cost of sociality. But having some cost doesn't just throw away all the results I'm going to show now. Okay, yeah, so is the picture clear? So there is a simple model of solitary migration, and assuming there is a benefit to migrating, and assuming there is a cost to investment in the migration, in your abilities, there's an optimum value you have to, there's an optimum value that you can easily find. Okay, cool. So what happens to this when there are other individuals, and when blocking social interactions are allowed? So in principle, you can think of solitary migration as a scenario where the density of the population is very low, then you don't even have an opportunity to interact, so there is no question of sociality. But as soon as the density is high, in principle, you can evolve your sociality to change the entire dynamics. That's what we're doing. So how do we, so of course, when we are doing a modeling, I can't just say any social interaction. I have to define a few possibilities of social interactions. So these are the possibilities we consider. So one is that we know, okay, for every individual is represented by a small disk. Okay, so by disk I mean that when two individuals come like this, they basically collide and go away. If they're too close to each other, they basically repel from one another. But that's because collision is something that every individual will avoid, and that's the repulsion. And you can think of this collision radius as roughly equal to the body size of an individual. Now. Here comes the real social interactions. So we allow possibilities for two kinds of social interactions. One is an ability to attract towards your neighbors, and an ability to orient your direction of motion with your neighbors. So, and in fact, we don't, when I say neighbors, the neighbors are defined as individuals within an outer circle you see there, outer circle of radius or S. And this RS is really comparable to body size. In fact, in our model, we chose RS to be equal to 3 times the body size. Which means you're not really talking to somebody far away there. I'm going to talk to only, maybe 6-3 individuals here. Okay? So, if there are individuals within your small radius of interaction, these are the possible things that individuals do. And you can write down. RS is equal to 3 times RA.
Can you repeat the question?
The question was RS. Okay. The question I think was probably how is RS related to RA? RS is equal to 3 times RA. And DSI is the desired direction of motion due to social interactions. And that I have given by the equations there. And what the first term means that there is a tendency to go towards the center of mass of all the individuals. I basically, if there is an individual here, I would like to go towards both of them. So eventually I will end up going in the average of the direction. And the second term is the alignment term, which is if you are going this way, if you are going this way, I would again average both of your directions and I would like to go in the direction. Okay? I mean, of course, there are many different ways to define these. Now, there are many different variants of this, but none of that really changes any of these results. Yeah,
please.
The J is inside that piece. Say that again? The summation over J is, the J's are only inside those in the RS circle. Yes, that's a very, very good point, yes. Yeah.
What does it mean if GSR is infinite? Because in the formula, GSR can get very hard.
Say that again, sorry, what happened
to you? This quantity you compute, GSR, can be infinite.
Oh, we normalize it eventually. Basically, we only use it to get the direction of motion, not the magnitude. Yeah. I mean, the denominator cannot really go to zero because we have a repulsion. Because as CJ minus CI gets smaller, there's eventually a repulsion at the radius RA. There's hardcore repulsion, so it never really goes to zero. Yeah. Okay. Is this a good distance? Okay. Okay, you have Ananya, you have a question.
Yes, so
why do you need attraction?
Can you repeat the question?
His question was, do we really need the attraction term at all? Well, it does help. It will allow us another possible collective motion. I will just demonstrate it in a bit. Okay. So let me summarize the what possible individual traits here.
In the unit center, we have represented as a circle. Is there any
conflict
that you pick the circle or is it?
What if you had a square? So I think the question was, I had chosen circles as the radii, you know, interaction. I call them interaction radii.
It's not a circle, it should be a sphere actually.
We are doing in migration, we are doing in 2 dimensions basically. Unless you are doing some marine fish species, yes, maybe 3 dimensions. But yeah. His question was, what if you had, I think maybe, let's say, something like a rectangle. So we have an analytical result of this which we never published, but according to that, as long as you have some interaction, local interaction, the geometry of it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Yeah. Metric distance?
Can we get into these
details? I can largely assure that those model details do not really change a large majority of these systems. Okay. So, and in addition to, basically individuals find their social direction of motion, they find their own desired direction of motion in the migratory gradient, that's DGI. And they have a DSI from the sociality, and they weigh them proportionate to their own strengths. For example, if omega GI is very small, the weight goes mostly to the DSI. Okay, so that's what I have kind of represented here. we have PGI and DSI, and once you have those directions, in fact, I made an error here in the figure, it's actually omega GI PGI, the lower arrow, and the other one is the omega SI DSI. So what this indicates in this representative figure is, if individuals have more sociality, you pay more attention to your social direction. Okay? And if you have more ability to go in the direction of, you know, migration, then if you have invested more, so you will pay more attention to that. And you add them vectorially, and on top of that, we also add an error term. Error term roughly represents the fact that when you eventually move, you are not making a deterministic decision. These are all stochastic decisions. Okay. So before I go into any evolutionary dynamics here, I want to explore what are the different possible movement dynamics that does this model allow, right? That's an important question. Imagine that you devise a model where you want to do evolution, but the allowed strategies are really minimal. I mean, you're really not allowing too many. The strategy space is very constrained, then obviously you're going to get biased results. So what we want to show here is that it does allow for a wide range of motion. For example, if individuals have very high sociality, but if they have very low omega G, which is gradient detection ability, then what you form is you form these swarms, which affect the center of mass, which effectively looks like a Brownian motion. Okay, you form this swarm, they don't have any directionality, nor do they move in a coherent directional fashion, but they're basically, you know, kind of just jiggling around. But maybe if you have looked at some bacterial swarms, they might look something like that. Okay? And this is something you may not be able to get without attraction. Okay. Now, if you have neither of the traits, that's also a possibility, right? Then you just do a random walk. Individual solitary random walk. And if you had a very high tendency to migrate, but you have no social interaction with anybody, so you just do a solitary migration. It basically goes back to the very simple model I presented at the beginning. And you have then an intermediate region where individuals do talk to each other. When I say talk to each other, they basically have a tendency to attract and align the direction of motion. And they move and they form many groups. I'm going to show some simulations of that. Basically, that leads to a collective migration. Okay. Now the question is, now we are going to introduce evolutionary dynamics to this entire model of motion. The idea behind that is, you know, I do not predetermine. So, okay, let me say that most models of collective motion assume that the population is homogeneous, everyone has some tendency for social interactions, they assume certain density, and then ask what are the patterns that are obtained. So the key difference here is, we do not assume that, the value of omega G and omega S are these. We let the evolutionary dynamic, which is the benefits and the costs, how they influence the fitness, we let those determine what the individual strategy is going to be. Okay? So we do not predetermine the individual traits in the population. We let the evolutionary dynamics determine that. Let me finish this, I can come back to this. And because of which you may have a wide range of possibilities, and we want to see what really happens. I can take it.
Just want to know how we introduce mutations.
Yes, I'm going to come to that. Okay, so the question is, where would the evolved population be in this parameter space, roughly? Okay. So far I have described the methods, and I'm going to now go into how we really implement the evolutionary dynamic. That's really your question. What's the selection algorithm we're going to do? So we start with there are many ways to do this, and this is one way. And we start with a large population of individuals. For example, these population sizes could range from 16,000 to 60,000 individuals. For those who are wondering how do we simulate them, we use graphic cards so that we can do a massive parallel computing. And once the individuals are put into the space, we let them move according to equations of motion. Now, so far I have described the equations of motion, right? There is a tendency to, depending on your trait, you may want to go, and depending on the relative values of the trait, you may want to go in the migratory direction or social direction. So once we have assigned those, and once we have put them on space, they will just follow the equations of motion. Okay.
So you just assign them randomly, is that what you
want to say? We assign the spatial locations randomly, okay? And we assign their initial orientation randomly. But we do initially, in the very first generation, when I say initially, I mean the first generation, we do assume that they all have some trait. Omega G, for example, is equal to 0. Omega S is equal to 0.
But you don't assign them assign the omega.
We have done that also, results not really change. Yeah. In fact, doing that increases the computational efficiency a lot. As I said, the other possibility is to do that, but here in this specific case I am going to present, I am starting to sort everyone with same values of omegas. Okay. Now we let them move in space and we wait for a period of time that we think is roughly equivalent to a generation time. Now during this period, we calculate how much it eats in each individual move in the direction of migration. Okay. And then that gives the benefit for every individual. And then we know the cost because cost is directly determined by the omega g value. We know the benefits that we compute by how they have moved. We know the cost because of what we have assigned. Different omegas have different costs. And we calculate the fitness, which is benefits minus the cost.
Distance.
Yes, the benefit is a vector distance, yeah, but the modulus of it. The displacement along the x-axis. Okay. Now we have the fitness. Once you have the fitness, what we do is we let every individual reproduce, assuming they're all asexual individuals, meaning the offspring will have the same trait as parents, but with a very small mutation. We determine the mutation by a Gaussian distribution with a mean value equal to parents' traits and a small variance around the mean. Okay, and the selection here comes because the probability that an individual reproduces is proportional to the fitness you gained in your previous generation. Yeah.
What about the error rate? You also have some errors.
Yes,
and
that's actually very important.
Is fixed, or this also is subject to selection?
The fitness is subject to selection. And the fitness has a component of error in them. Right? So imagine we two have the same omegas, okay? But just because our decisions are not deterministic, there is an element of error. After 100,000 time steps, I may have a slightly higher benefit than you have.
I was asking about the sigma. You have a sigma. Asking if sigma also is subject to selection.
Sigma is not subject. Only omegas are subject to selection. Yeah, that's a good point. Now, whether the ability to detect your gradient, that's determined by sigma, is also selected. But I think in principle you can reasonably get them because they are in the same equation with a linear term, both of them. So you can just rescale one of them.
You started with a beta term also.
Yes. So I think what he was saying was the sigma, the coefficient sigma of the eta term, is that subject selection. I said you can divide the entire equation by sigma. So it's basically one trait, which is omega g by sigma, that we are selecting. And then the omega s, which is the social. Okay. And we keep doing this procedure until an equilibrium of distribution of omegas is found. So, is it clear? Okay, let's see what happens now. So the main parameter now is then ad hocly introduce the cost. Of course, everything is ad hoc in some sense, but assuming that the fitness has certain, you know, is proportional to the migratory direction, the parameter I'm going to vary is how does the cost of gradient climbing influence the evolved strategy. So I will show you some videos of. Okay, what I'm going. Let me tell you what I'm going to show. So the dot there represents. Okay. So I'm going to show a plot here, where on the x-axis is omega g, the migratory ability. On the y-axis, sociality. I will start all the population at some the population with same omegas. Okay. And you will see those omegas moving in this plot. What that means is that What's happening across generations? What's happening to the distribution of omegas in the population across generations? That's what you're going to see. And this is for the scenario when there are no costs associated with gradient climbing. So if there are no costs, the x-axis, which represented the omega g, basically shoots up. Because there are no costs, the more higher the omega g you have, further you will migrate along the direction of motion. Migration of gradient, and therefore you will have higher benefits, and so you are likely to have more offspring and so on. But just that argument just continues. Fairly straightforward, I think. It's exotic. Now, let's look at the other extreme, which is very high cost of gradient climbing. What do we find if the costs are very high? I mean, you can probably expect that. So If the costs are very high, what you can imagine is that you get benefits of migration because you're migrating, because you have high omega, but then you're probably paying more cost than the migration actually gave you. So you may be just better off being a non-migrated individual foraging locally. You know, you're just happy that resources alone are better than going far away, which is very expensive for a number of reasons. It could be predation or it could be the cost of finding the route of migration. So these are fairly obvious results. So in one extreme, everyone had very high omega G, very high gradient detection ability. In the other extreme, nobody had them. So it just kind of makes sense. So here is the most interesting scenario, which is the intermediate cost of gradient planning. So in the intermediate cost, what's actually happening is the entire population splits into two strategies. We call them a bimodal strategy. And what you see here is we have a bunch of individuals who have no sociality, but they have a high omega G, which is they have a strong tendency to migrate, but they don't care about anybody else. And then you have a subpopulation which have a high omega S, but they don't really have any omega G. They are basically happy just being social. Now, what exactly is happening is something we want to understand now. I'll show you another. So in this simulation, let me just repeat if I can. So in this simulation, I started with omega S equal to 0 and omega G is equal to some 0.6, right? I'm going to show you another graph where I start with the different initial distribution of phenotype, these traits, and see what we find. So this is the x-axis, the generation number, and the y-axis are two traits. The first one, A is omega G, the B is omega S. And what you're seeing here is we started with basically 0 on 0. Neither of them had any of the two traits. But they eventually pick up, once again they show a similar, this branching phenomenon. So, and if you plot it as a three-dimensional plot, where you show along the axis omega G and omega S, what's the frequency of distribution of these traits, you find that, once again, we have individuals with low sociality and a high omega G, and another set of individuals, a subpopulation, which have no ability to claim the gradient, but they're highly social. So, I have been telling you we are doing a spatially explicit model. So what's really happening in the space? That must be driving all this, right? So let's look at what happens if we take these strategies, assign these to individuals, and let them move in space. So this is a simulation where I have marked green and blue for our own purposes. Individuals cannot recognize the traits of other individuals, okay? So the blue individuals here are the ones who have high omega G, meaning they have high ability to climb the gradients. And we kind of informally refer to them as leaders. They're not leaders in the sense that, oh, hey, I'm the leader, come back, come follow me. Because they're passive leaders, they're just doing their own job. They're not trying to carry anybody with them. But the green individuals who have tendency to attract and align with anybody who comes near them, they just stick around, and they even stick around with the blue individuals. And they have no hesitation in doing so. And that's precisely what's happening, and I'll just repeat this. So this is a close, zoom-in picture of a single group, what's actually happening in a single group. We have these two sets of individuals who self, I have put them all spatially in random locations, but when the groups form, groups, just by chance happen to have both sets of individuals. And the blue individuals, as I once again let me remind you that this coloring is only for our purposes. Individuals cannot see their other traits. They're just doing their own thing. The blue individuals who are leaders, they self-sort to the front of the groups. And they go in the direction of migration. And the green individuals, just by the virtue of being attracted to others and being with the virtue of just aligning the direction of motion with others, the entire group picks up migration. So we call this collective migration. So let's zoom out a bit and see how different groups could be organized. So we find that groups need not have same sizes. They come, as a consequence of this fusion dynamics, groups merge and split from each other frequently. As a consequence of this, the groups may have very different sizes. And each group, as you can see, also have different number of leaders in them. So what we did was we took these simulations, and within the simulations we quantified how does the number of or the proportion of leaders vary with group sizes, because we have different groups, right? So what we found was extremely surprising. As the group size increases, the proportion of leaders who are leading, guiding them, actually reduces drastically, and it reaches a small constant value. Okay, and of course I have shown you one scenario here. You know, here I am trying to summarize the entire picture. On the top left is the first scenario when there was no cost of gradient detection ability. That led to the fact that everyone was basically a leader himself or herself, and the entire, and they also had some sociality because of which they also came together and they also migrated. And this is a collective migration of cohesive groups. You know, there is no fission dynamics that occurs here. And in the central picture is the result where the population split into different strategies. We have leaders and we have social individuals. And there are three possibilities below. And one of them is solitary migration. This is what happens when the cost of sociality is very high. You know, you're better off just migrating on your own without bothering to interact with others. And they all migrate. But you know, if you just visually observe, they might look like collective migration because they're all going to the same target. But we haven't done this, but I think we can quantify the inter-individual distances and how the direction of their movements are correlated or not. Using those two, I think we will be able to distinguish whether they are really collective motion or whether there's aggregations going to a same common direction. And you also can also, yeah.
Yes. The question is,
the solitary migration, it's another pattern, but it looks similar to the collective migration. The answer is yes, it looks similar, but we haven't done this, but I think we can quantify the differences between them. For example, using the inter-individual distances, that's one. And even more importantly, whether the direction of their motion, because they keep moving, making errors, right? Whether that correlated or not. If they interact socially, they have a tendency to move like their neighbors. So their direction, the way they move will be related to what their neighbors are doing. If that is absent, you can probably conclude that these are not collective migration. And you can also have a scenario when the costs of both I did show the scenario when you have costs of migration is very high, then you have resident swarms, and you have cost of both the traits very high, then they are just solitary random individuals. They either migrate, they neither, you know, form groups. So this model is able to kind of produce different kind of possible movement strategies under a selection for migration. Okay. So what exactly is the role of social interaction here? It's worth wondering. So I told you that the leaders who detect the gradients, they are paying a cost for doing so, right? And nevertheless, you have both leaders and the social individuals who are both present in the evolutionarily stable state. So what really is maintaining this coexistence between two strategies? Despite the fact the leaders are actually paying costs. So what we do find is, being at the front of the group, occasionally these leaders kind of have a tendency to split from the rest of the group and they move ahead. And at that instance, the entire social-only individuals kind of get stuck for a while until they find another set of leaders who can guide them. So they, even though they do migrate, they don't migrate as efficiently as the leaders would. So this was the dynamic we found in these systems. Yeah?
I thought that in migratory keys, the leader's role is switched.
That's the hydrodynamic reason, really. I don't know if that would be a right system to apply.
Sorry,
this
to.
So the question, I'm sorry, you have to repeat this again. Okay. The question was, the migratory geese appear to switch the leaders appear to switch the roles again and again. Now I don't know how this model specifically applies to migratory geese. I think it's worth thinking about it. For example, does migratory geese all have leaders there? Does everyone know where to go? Does everyone have the ability to sense the gradients? And if everyone has the ability, then possibly for energetic reasons, they might switch roles. And I don't know of any evolutionary models that kind of tests whether, if you have a bunch of individuals, for energetic reasons, does this kind of a rotating leadership emerge in an evolutionary model? I don't know if anyone has actually done that. It seems like an interesting question. So I don't know how, there is a relation, but I don't know how this directly applies to the system. So what actually is happening is the social individuals are exploiting the leader's ability to migrate, and leaders compensate by moving further, and therefore the two strategies can coexist. And this results in a collective migration, the spatially collective migration. And in our model, I want to emphasize that these evolved migratory populations, actually, imagine that everyone was solitary. Okay, and everyone had this optimum I showed you in the beginning. If that was indeed, if you do that, you are likely to, you actually migrate further and more efficiently than this. The fact that you can actually exploit other individuals, in fact, that leads to entire groups doing worse, the entire population. Yes.
Could leaders get a benefit from being attached to followers?
Could leaders? Potentially, yes. For example, could leaders get benefits of being in groups with solitary and the non-leaders? The answer, I think, is yes. For example, if you are in a group, you are less prone to, you have a lesser risk of predation. Larger the group, smaller the risk of predation. So that's one way I think it can help. On the other hand, leaders tend to be in the frontal rows, frontal positions, and there is experimental evidence to show that increases the chance of being attacked. So I don't know how we can, how we balance this out.
If this leadership, most of the leadership, eventually, because of the benefits they are getting from the other members of the group, is there any tendency of the member of the other group to become the leader and overtake
the... So we do not allow switching strategies within a generation. Yeah? So even if we do allow, we find that that doesn't occur. We have a slightly different version of the model. One can think of a possibility, leaders somehow could figure out that there are other individuals following me. So what we allowed the possibility was, if somebody recognizes that there are too many individuals around me, maybe I can exploit others now. So I will switch off my omega gene. So we allowed for that possibility, but even when we did that, we found that the same kind of this evolutionary branching occurs. Because what happens is, when the group sees some size, everyone thinks the same, I will switch off and I will just follow others, then the entire group actually not migrate anymore. And in those groups, the individuals who do migrate, who do leave the groups and go on migration, will do better than those who switch off. So it actually works better if your omega G is always working.
It's not quite true if you take into account the effect of hydrodynamics.
Possibly.
Use of the weight of the bird in front of them.
Possibly, as of now, we have not included any hydrodynamics here. I think it would be good to think, for example, do we need an entirely different model, or can we just change some of the parameter values to account for the possibility of hydrodynamic interactions and the costs and benefits of it? Okay, since I am running out of time, can I move on to the next?
I think you should.
Yeah, shall I? Okay. So I have just given a it's a theoretical model, abstract model, and we have been thinking of how one can potentially test these ideas. We have some ideas, but they're not very confident they will work. So if you have any ideas, do let me know. We'll be happy to discuss. Now, following this, we also did an experiment, I'm going to describe how can these kind of collective motion can be selected in real world. Okay. How do we do this? So it has been known for a long time that predation can lead to group living. When I say group living, people have largely focused on the fact that individuals are not solitary. They are in a group of, let's say, n number of individuals. And they most often discard the fact that individuals are also moving as they're in groups. So that aspect has been not done. So that's what we wanted to test, whether a collective motion can also be selected for. Now, before I go into that, I want to give a very brief history of this field. One of the very first seminal papers in this was by Hamilton. Are there any other papers? No, it's okay. By Hamilton, something called selfish herd hypothesis. Now, how does it work? The idea is, imagine there are predators around you, okay? And if there is a population of prey, and the predator has a tendency to attack the nearest prey, okay? Now, given these rules for predator, there are two rules here. One is, predator appears randomly in the space and attacks the nearest prey available to the predator, okay? Now, given this, what should you do? It turns out, Hamilton showed in a very elegant way that all that you have, if you want to reduce your risks, all that you have to do is just get closer to somebody else. By doing that, you will reduce the area around you that is vulnerable for predation. Okay? Now, you apply this recursively, and what you will find is, grouping is a good strategy. Basically, be closest to anybody around you. And everyone does the same thing. And so basically, grouping is an evolutionarily stable strategy under predation. Okay? Now, and then there have been other studies that look at how the spatial position could influence predation. For example, the individual at the edges, are possibly more likely to be attacked by the predator, because obviously it can't jump into the middle first. It probably attacks the edges first. So there have been a bunch of studies, but not much focus on the movement aspect. Okay? We want to see if we can do something about that. And I want to emphasize here, one might be wondering, you know, aren't groups easy to detect? And if once the groups are detected, don't you have plenty of food, you know, abundant food to eat? So I want to make two comments on that. For now, regarding aren't groups more conspicuous? Yes, they are more conspicuous. However, the dilution in the risk by being in a group reduces much faster than the increase in the conspicuousness. So basically, even with the conspicuousness of groups, grouping is a better strategy for reducing the predation risk. Second is, what if the predator just eats every individual in the group? Well, if that does happen, it can also be shown that grouping is not a favorable strategy anymore. So under the condition that a predator is satiable, and that's the only condition, then grouping can actually avoid. So what's the role of coordinated motion? There have been hypotheses that suggest that basically if a predator attacks, there is a transfer of information across the group because everyone tries to push each other, they have social tendencies. And we wanted to do something to do with that. Okay. So what we did was, see, it's hard to go and do something like this in the wild. So we came up with an idea, which is that we found that there are these bluegill sunfish, which are, you know, again, fish found in the freshwater lakes in North America. And funny thing is, if you project some dots, like laser, if you take a laser pointer, and if you project them on the side of a tank, they have a tendency to go and eat them on the walls. They can't really eat them, they have a tendency to go and attack them. So once we figured this out, thought, okay, you know what, something can be done with this. So this is what we did. Okay. So we made a simulation, just like I was showing you, and we showed the simulation with the bluegill sunfish using this setup. So we have a computer where I have very similar rules for Django describe again, and the projectors displays the simulations to the real. I'm sorry, the projector displays the real predator. This is a real fish. And we will measure the response of these predators to this moving guide. Basically, like a fish playing a video game. Okay. So, now what are the... So this is a slightly modified model of the one that I presented. So, individuals now have basically effectively two traits. One is the tendency to attract with your neighbor, and tendency to align the direction of motion with your neighbor. Okay. And so, depending on the values of those omegas, you will either do more attraction or more alignment or a combination of them, and you then move at every time step. Okay. So, is it clear? And then again, on top of that, there is a randomness to account for the fact that none of these are precise. Okay. So, what's the population we choose? So, we choose just 16 individuals in our simulation. Say I was choosing 16,000 for my simulation. Because simulations you can run any long, it doesn't really matter. But when we are doing experiments, they are constrained by a number of factors. You know the best one, I know. So we chose just 16 individuals. But here is a key trick. We wanted to measure the selection pressure. So what would you do when you want to maximize selection pressure? You introduce maximum variation in your traits. That's the best bet when you want to see maximum selection pressure. So what we chose was, which is a population of 16 individuals, where every individual had their own set of omega attraction and omega alignment. Okay. For example, the crosses represent the traits of different individuals. So the x and y axis represent the trait space, and everyone has some abilities. Okay. And so we have a heterogeneous population now, and we put them all together and let them follow the equation of motion. Everyone has their own omegas; they will do their own dynamic. As a consequence, what we find is, for example, the guys with 0,0, they just move like random walkers. In fact, they do. And they appear, so you find solitary individuals moving around a lot. And you also have a bunch of individuals who have strong attraction. So you also find swarms, groups that form that don't really move in any specific direction. And since you also have set of individuals who have stronger alignment tendencies, you also have groups that actually make polarized motion. So I'll just show you a simulation. So basically, you have different group sizes, different properties of group motion, and in fact, even solitary individuals. We have a combination of them, and what we wanted to see was, if the fish is playing a video game, what will it go on for attack? And then we substitute attack for fitness, risk and fitness. So this is what the fish sees. I don't know if you can see it. So this is roughly what fish is seeing. So you can see that there is a group,
it's not really moving much, this is swarming, and they have, you have a couple of solitary individuals, and then you also have this group was probably the So you have a group which is moving in a directed motion. You have solitary individuals, three of them, and then you have a group that's swarming. I mean, we call them swarms because they don't have direct motion. So you have a bunch of possibilities for the fish to attack. Okay? And so this is an example, and then we project this to the side of a tank, fish tank, and then this is an example of a fish attacking a group. And since we are doing the simulations, right, we know exactly the traits of every individual. So we can go back to our simulation and say, who was this prey who was attacked? Did this guy have a stronger attraction tendency? What exactly was these guys' omegas? So we can go back and do this. So we did this repeatedly. And we had 70 trials. And what I'm going to show here is the crosses again represent the traits in the population, the heterogeneous traits in the population, and the circles represent the number of times they were attacked, the size of the area of the circle. So what you clearly see is the guy who has a balance of both attraction and alignment tendencies was actually never attacked in the circle. This is really small sample, I admit that. But nevertheless, we were able to show using a bunch of statistical analysis, which I'm not going into now, that the guys with alignment only, or even attraction only, were attacked significantly more than those who balanced both. So, what we can now do is, you know, we have. They get the same. So now we can come. So these are the number of attacks. Then what we did was just like we do in simulations. So once you have a risk profile, we can convert them to fitness. And then once you have a fitness profile, you can implement genetic algorithms that will have with the next generation. And in that generation, you can basically, the individuals were reproduced based on the relative fitness in the entire population. And when we did that, we found that the second generation populations had high tendency to be in the social interactions. And of course, there will be a number of analysis because there are lots of frequency dependency here. I won't go into details here, but the main point of our paper was we were able to show to some extent that using a combination of simulations and real predators, that collective motion can be selected in these kind of environments. So I'm almost ending the talk. I want to talk about this, but I don't think I would have had time to prepare actually. So in another work. So another extreme form of predation is intra-specific predation, which is cannibalism. And locust swarms, as I mentioned earlier, they can contain billions of individuals and they migrate massively from across continents. And it's most often, and when they migrate, they devastate many agricultural land en route. And it is many people have been wondering what kind of a cooperative strategy this is. Being solitary probably does not help them find food. So maybe by being in groups, they're able to travel further and therefore they can find newer habitat patches. That has been a qualitative understanding that people have been thinking about. Recently, some experiments by my friend and other colleagues have shown that these locusts are actually cannibalistic. They have a tendency to basically eat their own species. And what we were able to show was, even with cannibalism, under the threat of cannibalism, we were able to show that at high density, the best thing to do is actually collectively move. I won't have time to go into the details, unfortunately. And with this, I would like to end my talk by saying that we have studied evolution of collective motion along migratory gradients, and another demonstration that it's feasible using a fusion of real predators and simulations, and the work on cannibalism. And I think that this theoretical and computational framework, I mean, although I have now not talked about anything about, group selection, price equation, anything, I think this potentially provides a very useful tool to study many of these questions. For example, the example that you put on group hunting, something I'm very interested in. And how can, for example, there are many questions one can address using this kind of paper. It has its limitation, but I think it could provide some insight. With this, I would like to thank everyone. This was basically done in
now Ian Chadwin and the Director of the Number of People and 100 meters. Thank you. What's this?
It was a very good talk. I want to cite an example of migration. It is completely an exception to all kinds of migration you see around the world. It is it's a multi-species migration basically of goats and sheep, which are domestic. And the main thing about this migration is that it is led by a human being and two or three dogs. And in the high altitudes of the Himalayas, the migratory route is not determined by the human being, but over generations it has been determined by the sheep, which go in search of greener pastures as the snow line recedes in summer, and when it snows in winter, they come back. Another characteristic is that when a snow leopard attacks this group, the snow leopard, it wants only one sheep to be eaten, but it kills almost all the sheep in the group. Okay, so there is no advantage of being in a group. It kills all the sheep, but takes only one. So this is something exceptional which I have seen. Thank you.
That's a very interesting observation.
About the migration route determined by sun angle.
Say it again, sorry, can you repeat the question?
The role of sun angle to determine the migratory routes.
Role of?
Sun angle.
Sun angle?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think some species do use the way they orient themselves using the sun, the solar position. I don't know much about it, to be honest. I think there is evidence that some species use even the constellation, the way they are oriented, and some species use the solar, and the polarized light, I think, is the mechanism there, and that might be the mechanism, more precise mechanism, yeah.
And
what's
the resources?
Solar? Oh, it's very extremely important. In fact, I see, in our model, we kind of assume that the more you go in one direction, there are more resources you're going to accumulate. And one can think of doing it more explicitly by having a gradient of resources. And as these indices go, you know, the indices at the front actually get more resources than the ones coming behind. And this does happen for example, in wildebeest, in migration in Serengeti. I think it's a very interesting problem to look at. It's a very important factor, there's no doubt about that.
Migratory behavior or
I don't think it's migratory behavior.
Can you repeat the question?
The question was lion and leopard species, they cannibalize on the cubs.
Subadults.
And because of the subadults move far away, this is migration. I do not think it's migration. Migration as of now is defined as a directed motion rather than, this is more like a dispersal or, this is more like a dispersal because migration has been a direction.
Right.
This is a very small point in relation to the wildebeest migrations. One reason given for why they travel on given lines is because by doing so, they reduce the risk of parasitism.
Oh,
because they get ticks, and if a lot of animals are going along with that same line, they reduce parasitism. So on the face of it, it looks like a kind of costly thing to do, but there is a benefit to it.
Yeah.
The other point I wanted to make was, in relation to that lovely slide you showed at the beginning of the sheep kind of going crossing a river, clearly when they get close to the crossing point, they're crowding together. So there's a change in the kind of the repulsion of being close to individuals. So I didn't know whether you could model that.
How would I model them? the question was, very interesting comments. How would I model the how yeah. sheep get into this small stream or even a river because they have a narrow window there, you know, to enter the river safely and then exit.
That's right.
And it has been probably done because they have trampled over the lake, you know, year by year. What is the model? I don't know. Maybe they have lesser tendency to repel. You know, the repulsion really strictly becomes body size rather than larger than body. Yeah. Like
one advantage against pigs.
Oh, the point is simply that if they're travelling lines along a path, they're less likely to get parasitized.
Why might that be so?
Well, because if there are any ticks there, they will be taken by the leaders.
Well, I said the ticks won't come back to follow.
No, because they're moving too quickly.
But aren't the number of ticks way too many? No?
I think the I don't know.
There has been some work done by chick.
Yeah.
You can model by a sort of attraction.
Just the orientation, I think.
Force, towards the
exit. True. And I think people have also used this to, you know, how should you design emergency exits in a complex building? Now, what's the, you know, if in case of emergency, what is the, how should individuals respond? People have done modeling of these things. Very interesting. Towards the end, you showed a graph where the individuals, if they are in an intermediate position, like they are having this migration as well as alignment. So they are in a better position. But initially, you showed that
who has better position?
I mean, the graph which you showed just 2-3 slides before the concluding slide.
Okay. That was in the experiment, right?
Yeah, that's the experiment.
So there is no migration here, by the way.
Yeah, the alignment and the attraction. Sorry?
Yes, it's the balance of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, coincidentally, in our earlier model, we had chosen that arbitrarily. You know, there's equal weightage for attraction alignment. Somehow, even in this experiment, that just comes out.
Yeah. And initially, you showed that the cost of this migration is high, then the population splits, and there is a subpopulation which is having almost no alignment and whatever.
Yeah.
So, is it expected that in that case, both these populations will get eliminated due to natural selection operating, and this is something which is expected to be carried on?
I did not get your question, sorry.
So, if that is a situation, like
which is the situation
with previously which you showed.
Migratory scenario.
Yeah. So, is
some
it expected?
Individuals.
Is it expected
that happened because there was a cost to be able to migrate, cost to find the direction of migration, cost of sense. So, you are suggesting there's a predation plus a cost to migrate. Then what happens? I think that what happens is precisely what I showed before. There would be a branching of populations into leaders and social individuals. Because predation alone can lead to social behavior, right? Of equal tendencies of attraction alignment. Yeah.
So your model kind of predicts that there have to be
certainly trait, I don't know genetically, but certainly in their traits. Yeah, if there is a genetically coded trait, yeah, I think so. Maybe there is one expression that changes, right? It doesn't have to be dramatically different. It's so because these social tendencies, they can be acquired within a few generations. There are recent experiments showing that schooling behavior, for example, is heritable in some statistical bats. So they don't have to be dramatically different.
So I was wondering that why is it that you cannot implement that simply by sort of want epigenetic switch on an individual basis, that they are genetically homogenous, but then there's something that drives the selection of leaders, so you don't need to have these two populations, subpopulations.
Yeah, basically, these show dramatically different on these specific axes, but the underlying genetic basis might be much more simpler.
I want to make that up. The point there is, in the case he is describing, the heritability of these two traits is rather low. But what you have is a conditional strategy
where you are either highly social and a poor range guide finder, or very good at going where you want to go and poorly social. These two are equivalent strategies which are just as good. But the heritability of the traits is low.
Okay.
Would that work in your model?
I will have to discuss more with you on this.
He just gave me the microphone, but this is a good occasion. You felt the first part of the talk. Which kind of bacteria model do you have in mind? I mean, do you have any kind of bacteria in mind?
Maybe those who have chemotoxic behavior, chemotoxic abilities.
So if you think it can apply to some kind of bacteria, then your hypothesis of selection, the segregation between leaders and followers, you can check it experimentally.
And you have to, in principle, impose an artificial selection environment, right? Of the similar kind.
I mean, if you just check, take the leaders and make the next generation, see if they segregate.
See, one possibility I considered, you can comment on this, was Pseudomonas. I don't know if that might work, but I'm not entirely sure their interactions are local or not, because they secrete these enzymes that can actually spread pretty far. So that was one concern we had, especially on a petri dish scale. But that's a possibility. Maybe someone who is expert on bacteria can comment on that.
Being even a large conspicuous group, the target tree for the visitors, okay, that means both there is omega G and omega S visiting the particular group. So imagine if a particular herd of zebras or deers attacked by a pride of lioness or something like this. In this case, the driver drive in such a way so that one particular individual is singled out of the group. And they also attack, these predators are also attacking group, and the other prey animals, they also live in group. In that case, how do you better explain this? That means...
That's a new paper. I think you're asking a coalition of group hunting with socially moving prey, right? Is that what you're trying to get at, roughly? Yeah, I mean, I think nobody has done that. I don't know the details. Yeah. I want to work on that, actually. Population of, sorry?
Should there be a minimum number of the brains?
Oh,
this strategy will work more efficiently or something?
So the efficiency is not a consideration here. It's the relative fitness that drives, right? So in fact, they might be doing suboptimally than they would do solitarily. So the efficiency argument, I think, just doesn't work in most of the game theory contexts. In terms of whether the number actually matters, the density does matter, not the numbers. So if you are in a very low density environment, you are unlikely to encounter any other individuals. So the social strategy does not work then. So everybody will be a solitary migratory individual. Of the predator, is it? We have no predators in the model. I mean, in the second experiment? The second? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm a bit lost.
Vishwa, I was just wondering, could you clarify where the game theoretical...
Oh, the game theory comes in the self-selection algorithm. The selection algorithm, that's a numerical implementation of game theory. Basically, you can think of constructing a matrix for this. The way Maynard Smith does, you know, you have a strategy, hawk strategy, dove strategy, or you have a cooperative or defect strategy, right? So you have discrete strategies. So you can think of having omega, if you restrict your omega g to 1 and 0, and omega s to 0 and 1, in that limit it goes to the, it looks like a Maynard-Smith matrix, the payoff matrix. But what we have is a continuous strategy that goes all the way from being, you can call the degree of, let's say, altruism in some sense, degree of defection, degree of, so that in a sense, because these, it made sense for us to implement it that way, because why should I choose omega g is equal to 1 as my discrete unit? It could be a continuously varying entity. So yeah, it's a generalization of the way Maynard-Smith implemented the game theoretic models. And this is actually, this comes under the name called adaptive dynamics, if that helps in any way. But it's basically a generalization of game theory.
Last question, Sylvia.
I'd like to follow up a bit with this. I didn't really understand whether your mutations occur at the whole population level at the time. So, because you said you have more replicates. So do you have that one individual mutates individually within a group, so that you have groups that have like a resident? strategy and one individual that has changed his strategy, or you just mutate the strategy of the whole population and then you compare these different populations?
Yes, the latter scenario.
Exactly, it changes
the latter scenario. Yeah.
Oh, the
latter
one.
Second one, yes.
Okay, because actually, I mean, I think it would be more relevant to biology to consider the other scenario where you have
one
subpopulation that is mutating.
Who's sorry?
I mean, usually in adaptive dynamics, one does this. You have one individual that is mutating in a population of residents. I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe
the
you
invisibility
have the same
analysis.
Outcome. I don't know.
Is it what you call the invisibility analysis?
No, I think the question is. Who mutates here? Every individual in the population?
Every individual will mutate with certain probability and which is independent of who is which is independent of everybody else.
So it is a biologically relevant model.
So mutations are all individuals
independent.
Mutate.
Every individual can mutate with some rate. Okay. And then once that probability happens and then there is a small shift in their omegas.
Okay. And that's
equally on the both directions.
The following question is, when you compute fitness, you said that you average over several realizations of this process.
Yes.
Is this just to speed up the simulations or it changes?
Sorry?
Is this only to speed up simulations or it measures?
It speeds up simulations. Yes.
Thanks very much, Ed. And, brief quick question, please.
And a brief answer.
Just wondering whether it would be profitable to simulate it. A kind of a charged Brownian particle floating in a specially designed.
Can you repeat the question? I don't
think I lost. Maybe you can.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Sounds good, yeah.
The question was, could you simulate a bunch of charged Brownian particles?
Charge meaning positive, negative charges? Or do you mean charged?
I guess so. Electrically,
okay, electrically charged. Okay. Okay.
And then calculate the amplitude.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you.